Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Grayscale Gorilla Podcast. As always, we have Chad Ashley here.
Say, how you doing?
What is up, buddy? Good to see you.
Everything's up. Glad to be back. Glad to be home.
And of course, we have Chris Schmidt looking good over there with the blue light behind you. Looking good, man.
Oh, thank you. Happy Monday, everybody. Back to work.
Back to work
for real.
Yeah, we've been at Seagraph for the last week. We've been in LA, out of town, been seeing our friends, customers. It's been a big week. And I think that's what we'll be talking about mostly today. Is, you know, giving you maybe the people that didn't make it to Seagraph or couldn't see it all, some of our impressions on the things that we saw and kind of what we learned at Seagraph. But, you know, how's everybody feeling? A lot of flying, a lot of handshakes. How's everybody feeling today? Happy Monday? Not happy? Good?
Great.
Lots to catch up on. Still short on sleep, actually. I had a bunch of stuff to do in the days in between. But, yeah, things are good. Good to be home.
Well, like this was our third time having a booth in general. So we last Seagraph 2017, it would have been. No, 2016. What date? What year is this? We experimented with getting a partner booth, is what they call it, at the Maxon booth. And that means that behind the Maxon booth, they have this awesome little area where we can get our own corner of their carpet and you know, hang out with our customers and show off some of our products. And so this was the third time us doing it. And it's always my favorite part, at least. It's always my favorite part to meet the customers, the people that come up and talk about how we've influenced their career and some of the products they use. So thanks to everybody out there that came up and said hi. I always appreciate it. And just love hearing the stories of how Grayscale Gorilla helps. That's what we're here to do. So I guess we could jump right into it, guys. Like, what was your overall feeling of the show? And maybe later we could talk a little bit about some of the more specific, you know, parts of the show and really what it is. But maybe, Chris, you've been to more of these Seagraphs than anybody. Can you kind of fill in quickly what Seagraph is and kind of talk about how the show was to you?
Yeah, I haven't done a count, but this is like my 9th or 10th Seagraph in a row. I haven't missed one since I started going. Although I got to say, once Pixar stopped doing the teapot giveaway, everything went down a little bit. Mm-hmm. Teapots were pretty great.
Oh, I forgot about that. No teapots this year. Yeah.
Well, they do. They give them out at the RenderMan events.
But it used to be on the show floor. And it was always fun because there's a gigantic snaking line of thousands of people and just crisscross. Sometimes the line would crisscross itself. Those were always the interesting ones. It's hard to understand how long those lines are unless you've seen them. But yeah, it's just a big kind of gathering of a lot of artists and technical people and the people writing the software and experimental technologies all along the lines of animation. And I don't even know what the technical, what does Seagraph even stand for? It stands for something.
Special Interest Group, SIGGRAP, of computer graphics, something like that.
Really?
Yeah, Special Interest Group for graphics. I think that's right.
Wow, that's great, man. I didn't even know that. Nice job, Nick.
Hey, man. Anytime.
Yep. But
that's don't quote me on that one. You know,
do your own research. Do you know that Seagraph is based, I believe, like the actual office of Seagraph is based in Chicago, or at least it used to be. Let me check. But
yeah, I think it still is. They used to have it a lot in Chicago, and then they started moving it around, and it ended up in LA for good reasons. It's a lot of visual effects. It's a lot of filmmaking. It's kind of centered on that, I would say, like 3D rendering, obviously, filmmaking.
Computer graphics.
Technology, computer graphics.
Yeah, computer graphics.
And then for me, what's fun is the Cinema 4D booth, and therefore like the Grayscale Gorilla booth that was kind of a part of it, ends up being the motion graphics center of Seagraph, which is always really fun. Like, there's so many, you know, people that work in film and the visual arts in general, and they're all at the show, but all the motion graphics artists like kind of huddle around the Maxon booth, which is so cool. It's so cool to meet everybody that does this stuff. And in some ways they're a little bit like, wow, there's a lot of visual effects around here, isn't there? I'm gonna stay over by cinema. So it's fun.
Yeah, I would say that I've been going maybe not as consistently as Chris, but my first one I think was probably maybe 1998 or something like that, somewhere in that vicinity. And man, I will say this: the show has shrunk a lot. Like, the floor used to be packed with with vendors and stuff going on, and the parties were like ridiculous. These parties that these companies would throw. I went to a party once that Rhythm and Hughes, I think, put on, and Etta James was performing, and like that's how ridiculous. So it was like this craziness. And then one year Autodesk put on, this one wasn't even that long ago. Autodesk threw a party in the San Diego SIGGRAPH on an aircraft carrier they just rented an aircraft carrier, and there was just like go-go dancers everywhere. And
they played Top Gun music the whole time.
Oh man. We were high-fiving a lot all over the deck, you know, just like Goose and Maverick. But yeah, I would say that it's gotten a little bit smaller, a little bit more chill. There's better like stuff happening. Like I feel like I didn't even get to see a lot of the talks that were happening in these little areas where you could see breakdowns of films and all sorts of stuff like that. I didn't get a chance to see that stuff. I know Chris, you went to see Blizzard talk, right?
Yep, the Blizzard Overwatch cinematic team talking about like mostly their pipeline and how they put their shorts together and about compressing that. But that was super fun. There's like 20 talks I would have wanted to go to, but then that's the only thing I'd be doing the entire show, which is what I have done in some years past.
Right. Yeah, the only talk that I kind of got into a little bit was the one on real-time rendering. And even that one was so... I was in a standing... The room... Like they couldn't take any more people, so people were watching it. It was like simulcast in the lobby area, so you could kind of stand in this group and sort of watch it and hear it. It was really hard, so I kind of bailed on it. But it was really interesting about these game engines taking on real-time rendering and what that means, and that was pretty interesting. But yeah, there's a lot to see, man. A lot to see.
Yeah, and as always, Maxon US and the whole crew always has awesome artists there. Throughout the show, they do the C4D live thing, which is awesome. They're streaming all these artists. They do breakdowns of projects. We got to talk a little bit about R19, show off some of the new features in that as well. And of course, we always get this question too. Do they record all that stuff, and when is it available? If you missed any of the talks or you got busy last week, you couldn't watch it, they tend to put those out within a month. They've been pretty fast about turning those around. And we'll also link it up on our website. They usually put them out on Cineversity, but we'll give you a heads up. Look for an email, and also on our training page, we'll set up a link so that you can watch all that stuff later. Chris did a demo. Chris, what was your demo about? And then I'll talk about mine a little bit, and we'll kind of maybe talk a little bit about the booth and what happened around then, and then we could talk about any other stuff.
Sure. It was actually I had a lot of fun doing this presentation. If you saw when we released Signal 1.5, I had an animation of this funky alien dancing tree. And I had actually tackled a whole bunch of different parts of Cinema 4D that I don't normally spend very much time in. And I was like, how much of this can I cram into a 50-minute presentation? So we kind of model and then sculpt and then UV unwrap and bake down the sculpt and do a little bit of texture work and then rig it up with joints. And then we clean up some of the weights and then use just a little bit of Signal at the end to make it bop around and cram all of that into it. But the whole point was tackling parts of Cinema 4D that you might be avoiding. I don't think a lot of people touch the sculpting, and I know a lot of people don't tackle the UV unwrapping and what? Just prepping some of those things. Yeah. And then like people always use, and I can even stare at some people here, we'll use the bend deformer when you should be using joints. And there's just,
I know he's not talking to me, Nick.
I don't know what you're talking about. Listen, bend deformer, it works.
But it's almost like
that's a t-shirt. That's a shirt.
I'm gonna get a t-shirt that says, "Yeah, I know how to animate characters," and that's just gonna be the bend deformer bullet.
Just going.
Yeah. The icon in the back on your back of your shirt is just the bend deformer. Character animator.
Ask me how I animate.
Listen, if you need an elephant trunk moving around, I'm your guy. I'm all in.
You say that, but if you were to just make a like three or four joint chain on there and say auto weight and then wiggle your elephant around, you would be so much happier with the results it would be giving you. Like, that's, yes, you can make it wiggle back and forth.
We don't deal in fake news around here, Chris. That's that's BS. There's no way. There's nothing easier than a bend deformer. So
the point being is a bunch of parts were all about there's parts of Cinema 4D that you might be avoiding, but there's a 5-minute version of it that you can do. You can unwrap your UVs and make them like 90% effective in like 5 minutes. Like you can sculpt, and if you limit yourself to these couple tools, you don't have to overthink it. Like getting a little bit of character rigging set up, you don't have to overthink it. There's a simple version of it.
I like that about your presentation where and I think it's always something we try to do at Grayscale Gorilla is like, this stuff's not as hard as you think. And to do it, you know, all the way and to learn every button, you know, there's a lot to learn, but to kind of mess around with sculpting, when I realized I could just throw a sphere in sculpting and start to like paint faces on it and stuff, you forget how easy they make it. So I like that about your presentation. It's going to, I think, open up a lot of potential doors in cinema that people tend to keep closed. Like, and I do it too, out of fear of like, that's too complicated. I'm not going to mess with sculpting and what was the other one you said? Oh, UV unwrapping and stuff like that. So that'll be fun to get out there, man.
UV unwrapping is such a pain point for people. And yeah, Cinema 4D's UV unwrapping tools kind of are antiquated and could stand a big refresh. But it's no reason, I think, to be afraid of doing it. I think you still have to know about it. You still have to understand it. So I like the fact that you covered that and made that a bit more approachable.
I got to bug you at some point, Chad, and ask you what your favorite UV unwrapping tool is. So I have a point of comparison because I've only really used the Cinema 4D one because that's always done what I needed to do. So sure. When everybody's like, I can't do these UVs, it's like, well, what do you want it to do?
Well, I mean, without getting too technical or into too much detail, it's more of the manipulation of the UVs that suck in cinema. The ability to relax certain areas easily and quickly, select and manipulate them, stitch them. It's just the workflow is a little bit convoluted. The fact you have to jump into a completely different workspace is weird. So in most other applications, they either use the internal UV, you know, whatever Max Maya, or they'll jump out. Even those software products don't have amazing UVs, so they'll jump out into things like what's that one? Headis UV Layout or 3D Coat or something that's like specialized in it that they can just jump in and jump out. I know a lot of people that do that. So it's really kind of about, you want the tool, like either Cinema Max, whatever, to be as good as it can be, but know that if you're going to do something really heavy, you probably should jump out to a specialist app, just like for anything else, really. But you want it to have that level where you really need to be hitting a high level of UV needs to jump out. Whereas like that's the most frustrating part for me in you being in cinema is the fact that it's just such a weird workflow coming from other apps. That's all.
Do you have a high value of UV needs? Come watch this tutorial.
There you go. Boom. I mean, with Triplanar though, like I feel like I try to avoid UVs as much as I can. I mean, you can't avoid them. You gotta have them on most everything. But there are certain ways that you can do what I call cheap UVs, where you just are doing like several projection areas on an object and then just using Triplanar to kind of like bring it all together. If you have an object, okay, so here's a perfect example. Chris won't like this example, but whatever.
for those of you listening at home, Chad's, what are you holding up there, Chad?
I'm holding a fidget spinner that I got from Seagraph. It's a shotgun from the Autodesk party, which we'll talk about later because it was an epic party. But if I was UVing this, for instance, I would like have a flat projection for the logo, and then I would use Triplanar for all the like scratches and imperfections so that I wouldn't have to unwrap this entire thing.
Think a UV mapping fidget spinner tutorial, I think, is right in the pocket, man. We got to put that on the tutorial list. What do you think, Chad?
I'm down. Chris, you want to make it?
I see. Passing it off already.
Yep. I'm saying, hey, man, why not?
All right. Let us know in the comments. You know,
let's change the subject. What were we talking about? The show.
Nick, Nick, your presentation.
Yeah. Talked about one of the new features in R19, which they announced, Cinema 4D R19, they announced, I think, Monday before the show. So about a week ago. And, you know, I've been playing around with the shatter. I always call it shatter, but it's fracture Voronoi feature in that they released in R19. And I go over this in my presentation, but the gist of it is that was a really awesome update, and I've always wanted built-in fracture tools. And what I love about the fracture tools is that they're procedural and non-destructive. So if you all of a sudden want double the amount of pieces on your screen, you don't have to like re-break the object. You just type in a bigger number, and it's just like how you think Cinema 4D should work. Well, in the new version, they've added things like glue and connectors. And those two things kind of sound the same, but they do two very different things. And mostly what it allows you to do is some of the things I've always wanted to do with fracture, which is throw things around the scene before they were broken. So one of the things I always wanted to do is like take an object, break it into a bunch of pieces, but then throw it at a wall or throw it at the floor. And here's the key, not have it break until it hits the floor or the wall. And that's really tricky to do when you're working with fracture, because everything's already busted. The whole model and all the dynamics is kind of working on this assumption like, hey, you broke us apart. So as soon as you throw us, we're going to act like we're broken apart. And what these connectors do, and in some ways what the glue does, is it kind of keeps pieces together until you want them to break. So it's
yeah, what's the difference between, one thing that confused me is because I thought glue, and I'm like, I barely touched R19, so I'm going to be like probably the majority of people out there. To me, glue says, okay, I'm going to hold this object together like glue. And then if it hits something and the force is strong enough, I'm going to break it apart. But if I'm not mistaken, that's actually connectors. That's not glue.
Yeah. And it can get a little confusing. I think maybe in other packages too, glue is there to say exactly the opposite of what I'm saying. Let me be more clear. So you're right. It's kind of backwards. What glue does is it allows you to break apart a bunch of pieces and then kind of pretend like you glue them all back together, but pretend you're gluing only like half of them back together. So if you think about it, if you use fracture to open up the middle of a sphere, if you just go right now in R18 and do a fracture of Voronoi and break a sphere open into three pieces, it's going to be three like orange slices. They're going to be very clean cuts, like, you know, really simple shapes on the inside. If you instead break that sphere into 200 parts and then glue all those 200 parts back together to create three pieces, it's going to create all this jagged geometry and all these little edges on the inside. Think of like if you break a rock open and it's like a geode and you have all this nice little crystalline geometry inside. That's what glue does.
I'm just trying to understand why they called it glue.
They called it glue because connectors already exist as a term in Cinema 4D. And so the word connector, which they would have used, was taken up for something else.
Yeah, almost like think of it backwards.
That's all I needed to know. Because yeah. I was like, wait, I still don't realize how this connects to glue.
Yeah, so connectors, what they did with connectors is what you would think of as glue, which is putting all these pieces together and then allowing forces to break them apart instead of just having them broken right away.
So yeah, that makes sense.
So what connectors does is the connectors in the new fracture adds a connector object between every touching piece. And then you get to describe how strong those connectors are so that now you could throw this object around and it'll stay whole until a certain amount of force is applied to a part of it. And as soon as that force is applied enough to that object, the connector will recognize the amount of force and then release those particles. So it gives you the ability to, you know, build a brick wall and throw stuff at it and only parts of the wall break and not the whole thing crumbles to the ground. This is much more easily describable with visuals. So we'll wait till that all comes out. But that, if you're interested in adding more fracture stuff or seeing what's new in R19, we have that also, by the way. Chris's newest tutorial on YouTube goes over some of these differences as well. So if you haven't seen that, that's our latest upload as of right now over on YouTube. And he'll show you some of the differences on glue and connect.
I'm going to go watch that. I'm going to watch that right after. I'm going to watch it right now, just during the show. All right,
see you. Bye, Chad.
See you guys later.
But actually, I wanted to throw one more thing in there, Nick. And I wonder if you got to implement this into your presentation. But something I didn't realize when I made that video was you can treat a Voronoi fracture like a fracture object, meaning you could take your own objects and then throw them in, and the separate pieces will kind of be acknowledged. You could additionally break them. But the point here being is our buddy Donovan put together a demo where he made like a white picket fence type thing. And he made sure all the pieces were placed very precisely and they're all touching each other. And he just took this piece of fence that he modeled up with like other cloners and whatnot, threw it inside the Voronoi fracture, and then said, turn on connections. And then it treated it like it was a built object. And when you crashed the sphere through it, like it kind of would snap and break and bend and twist. I was like, whoa, like I didn't think about that. That's amazing.
Yeah, I got to play with it. I mean, I used to play with this tool in Max called Rayfire, which is kind of a destruction effects tool in 3ds Max that's very similar. It has like it's called what they call connectors, Rayfire calls glue, and it's like perfect for doing that kind of stuff where like you have a fence, like you said, and you set it up right and it just should react the way you'd think it would react. So yeah, I'm excited to play with that. What other like, let's talk about R19 for a minute while we're on that subject. What do you guys, what's your, like, I haven't really opened it up and played with it much, but I have some opinions on it, but I want to hear, you guys have played with it more than me. What's your thoughts on R19?
Yeah, I mean, I'll go quickly first. I haven't had a ton of time either. I went straight to my favorite stuff. The fracture and the MoGraph tools are kind of where I tend to spend most of my time anyway. I think that's an awesome update. It works faster, it breaks faster. Like every part of that new update is really fun. Other stuff I've played with is the new viewport, which looks gorgeous. You know, they introduced these new PBR materials. And so that allows you to get a lot more visual in your viewport and to be able to see your reflections and be able to like eyeball your HDRs on your reflections without having to render all that kind of stuff. They've even introduced depth of field, which is really interesting. I haven't played with it a ton, but you could kind of start to visualize your depth of field without having to always hit render, which I think will speed up a lot of people's workflow if you're using physical and standard and stuff like that. Other than that, they got this spherical camera, which I haven't played with, but seems interesting for VR kind of stuff. And then the core parts of Cinema that they're starting to implement these new media cores and new modeling cores and stuff that I know. I think Chris, you might have a little bit more knowledge on that stuff. What are your thoughts, Chris?
Not super specifically. I don't know the core. I know a lot of the core is like just data handling to speed that up with like imports and exports and getting information in and out of Cinema. One of the other big features they put in is the sound effector, which is kind of new and improved. And I think I don't know a lot about it. I never really used the old sound effector. But it sounds like it's a lot more like sound keys now, where you can draw multiple boxes and start driving out in multiple parameters from there via Expresso.
Yeah, a couple of people came up to me and were like, well, does this sound, the new sound effector, kill signal BPM? And I'm like, no, it's a totally different thing. So let me put this to rest. And Chris, by all means, jump in. So the sound effector that they put in is very much like you described. It's isolating frequencies and trying to drive sound with frequencies. Now, signal, what that does in BPM, it's very different. You don't import a sound file. You don't have to like worry about capturing the frequency. It's strictly about knowing the beats per minute to your track and animating on that timeline. So the sound effector could even be driven by signal if you wanted to. So it's not conflicting. There's no overlapping features other than the fact that they both can use sound in different ways to drive animation. Does that make
sense? Yeah, spot on.
Cool.
Yeah, that's a good way to describe it. And we can't leave out ProRender. I think there's a lot of people talking about it. I personally, you know, haven't played with it too much. And, you know, anytime there's a new, you know, piece of technology like that, I'm kind of waiting to see how it works. You know, I'm not sure if it's going to speed things up or I don't know. Have you guys played around too much with this?
Not very much at all.
Yeah. It's not there yet. A lot of people came up to me, being the rendering nerd that I am at the show. They're asking me, like, you know, what do I think? Should I still pursue this, that, the other thing? It's not ready yet. And they've even said it. It's not production ready yet. In fact, I'm not even sure if you can animate or render animations yet. In addition to that, I'm not a huge fan of the engine that it came from. which was called FireRenderer back in 2014. And it's actually, there's a free plugin that you can get to use it in 3ds Max and Maya. So if you, it's been around a while. It's just not something that I think is there yet. Now, can they take it? Can it get to a place of like, you know, Arnold, Redshift, Octane, whatever? Yeah, it probably could if it receives enough attention. So I'm hopeful that it gets there and it gives people an in-app experience that I think that they're craving, that they're not getting currently. So if it can get to that point, awesome. Right now, it's not something that I'm currently recommending people use in production, and I don't think they would either.
Yeah, I've heard similar stuff. You know, I haven't had to play with it, but I've heard basically if you're using physical, it's a good time to experiment with it, see if it speeds anything up for you, and play with it. Like if you're getting the new version, definitely try it out. But it's, I don't think it's going to replace something like Arnold or Octane or for anybody right now. So yeah. More news as we get to play with that more. This is all new to us too. Yeah. Anything else on?
I mean, there's a long list of little things. They sprinkled things throughout where there's the new level of detail object, which I think with a little bit. So you can put in like different collections of objects where it's like, here's high poly, low poly, like medium. And then you can set it like based on certain distances or other different things to trigger depending on how close it is to the camera. So that you can kind of very interactively change your scene and have it speed up or slow down depending on if you're at a detailed area. They completely redid the polygon reduction tool.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, it used to be a deformer, but now it's a generator object, and it like maintains the UVs and processes things quicker.
That was always stunning to me how slow it was before coming from other applications that could just do that process so much faster. I'm glad to see that that's going to be sped up.
Well, the interesting thing with it, and I hadn't realized, but when you throw in an object in the old one, every time you change a parameter or did any kind of refresh of anything, it had to like recalculate everything from scratch. What happens with the new one is it caches like the important data. And then so you can very quickly and interactively drag up and down the calculation. That does mean if you throw in a crazy object, it's going to take a little bit and your little progress bar is going to be like, okay, figuring it out. Okay, cool. Now I got it. And now you can interact with it very quickly.
No, that's great. I mean, yeah, I agree, man. There's lots of little things that I think are going to make people's lives a lot easier.
Let me throw out the most important little thing that will make lives easier. And man, when I think about some of the workflow tricks I've had to do this, it's mind-blowing. But if you were to do something like you have 20 different splines and they're all just letters and you want to put them all into their own loft or their own lathe or their own anything, before, you know, you could hold down what is it? I always forget the shortcuts. My hand knows it, my brain doesn't. Where you hold down like Alt and it makes a parent, you hold down Shift and it makes a child, maybe the opposite. But you can only do that on one object at a time. But now if you grab all 20 splines and you say, and you do make a parent, it'll make a new sweep for every single one of the objects, or add this cube in as a child in every single one of the selected objects. It's like such a tiny thing, but like I think it's going to dramatically change like that, the speed of that type of workflow. You know, that's one of those things where it's going to save everybody minutes a day,
right?
Which is weird to say, but like it's going to save the frustration of that very repetitive, like, okay, I'm going to make a copy of this, put this one in, put this one in, rename that one, put this one in. Nope, just does it automatically now, which is,
I think
it's super huge.
Another thing that's not super huge, but I didn't at first, I was just like, what is this? I don't get this. Is they introduced this whole idea of, they needed a way to show people what was new in the application. So they had this idea of like, so every new feature or new parameter is going to get this color and it's going to be colored differently. Now, if you don't know that, when you open it up, you're like, what is with this horrid, ugly yellow color they're introducing into the UI? And if you're like me, you're like immediately throwing your hands up saying, what are they doing? They're ruining it. And the idea is that that's not what they're doing. They created this like little feature, which just changes the color of the parameter in Cinema 4D to this yellow color so that you know what's a new feature and what's not. So after a while, when you kind of familiarize with yourself with it, I believe it times out and switches back to the regular UI color. Or if you're impatient and you don't want to look at the yellow color, you can go into the preferences and change it.
I think it's pretty smart. It's almost like a video game type feature where they've gamified it a bit, where if you, once you, when you click it once, it'll go to like half the shade. It gets a lot more dimmed out. But once you've clicked it, I think 20 times, it turns off. It's like, okay, they've used it enough. They know what it is.
That's really smart. And I didn't realize how smart that was until I kind of saw it on the show floor and like saw it happening and saw people using it and noticing it. And I'm like, man, that's pretty damn smart, guys. Nice job.
Yeah, that's a really cool feature. I I didn't know what it was either. And then Chris told me, like, oh, this makes a lot of sense. It actually helps you dig really quickly into some of the new stuff. Sometimes there's just a new checkbox somewhere.
Right.
And you could go, sometimes it just goes unnoticed. Like, what was that checkbox always there? When did they introduce it? And so this is a really smart idea to kind of let you find all the Easter eggs and play around with them. That's fun.
Go ahead. I just had one more thing I was going to mention.
No, go on. We should transition to, you know, some of the other parts of Seagraph. But what else? What do you got?
Well, I think you touched on it a little bit is the stuff that they're doing under the hood to speed up Cinema 4D is really starting to show now. And they've got stuff with the new modeling kernel that they're introducing. And then, of course, all the stuff that you already mentioned, which was the media core. Yeah, the media core. Thank you. So there's stuff that they're doing there that is exciting to me because I know that, you know, programs get a little long in the tooth and they have to be updated to make them faster and take advantage of multi-core systems. So it's exciting to me that they're doing that stuff and I'm seeing it and I'm excited to see where it goes. So that to me was like, all right, they're really making an effort to kind of go under the hood and speed some of this stuff up.
I think it's those things that brought, I guess you could speak for yourself, Chad, but to those improvements are the things that brought you over from other platforms to Cinema 4D more than all the new fancy features, speeding things up, things like takes that they've introduced in the past, those like really heavy workflow things that just generally speed up how you work and really allow you to dig deep into the core is bringing some of the more professional people or just people that have been doing this for a long time that expect these kind of things. So
right,
yeah, this is it's good that they mix it up a little bit of everything, a little bit of this, a little bit of that. One's looking one way, one's looking the other. So what?
Oh wait, I gotta mention one more feature that I really love, which is they finally added in. I don't want to say finally. One of the most powerful things that got added in Cinema 4D years ago was these fall-offs. Like, so many objects have fall-offs now. And they've added in a new type of fall-off. They've added in a noise fall-off. And you can use all the different types of noise inside of Cinema 4D. And it really opens up a bunch of cool new possibilities of things falling off based on a three-dimensional noise. So I can't overstate. It's easy to mention that, but like the applications for this are going to be wide ranging.
Agreed. I think that was really cool. That should have been one that we mentioned earlier. It was definitely needed. I think if you had X particles, you had access to it, right? Like there was an actual noise fall off that comes with X particles.
I don't know if that translated into other objects, but
maybe not.
Yeah, I think that works only with X particles. I guess you could use it with other stuff, but you had to own it.
Yeah,
definitely.
Right. Yeah. So that's very cool. All right. So expanding our view from Seagraph Maxon booth outward, what did we see? What were we excited by?
Did you know that VR is a thing?
I didn't know that, but
have you heard of VR?
I was reminded every 2 minutes because the booth next to us was literally a big box where they had people in Vives, right? HTC Vives. With machine guns, and they were like fighting some battle that we had no idea what the hell they were fighting. But every time you came to our little area of the booth, you just heard them shooting these guns and like screaming. So all day, that's what we had to listen to.
They sounded like airsoft guns. Like,
yeah,
so they actually had like an audible, like clicking, like kind of noise.
The demo seemed very compelling. There were people freaking out. I guess so. I took a little bit of a walk around and I saw that they were. They basically put you in an empty room and then throw zombies at you and make you shoot them. And they come like one at a time and then two at a time. And at the end, when everyone seems to be freaking out, just like 100 of them come around the corner. And it's just
it's a nightmare. It's basically my nightmares.
Yeah, although it was kind of loud, it looked like it was a pretty compelling demo compared to the people that were just physically freaking out. But yeah, a lot of VR stuff happening around. I think a lot of real-time rendering. You know, NVIDIA had a big booth showing off a lot of graphic card real-time stuff, a lot of VR. A lot of that feeds into VR, right? A lot of these real-time engines are built for that. But yeah, I mean, I would say it was a lot of VR stuff. And it was just kind of nice catching up with some of the other companies as well. Like I know we wandered over to the Redshift booth. That was cool to meet them. You know, the Redshift team got to meet them and see what they're up to. There's actually one of my favorite moments was Chad at the Redshift booth. And they had this awesome machine that they were demoing Redshift on. And they, of course, they had some shiny spheres up there. And so I had to go look at what they were up to. And and Chad's like, you mind if I just play with this? And within a couple minutes of Chad sitting down and like starting to mess around with Redshift inside of Cinema 4D, there was like a crowd around him. Like, oh my gosh, Chad's demoing Redshift, which, you know, everybody wants, but we can't do a Redshift demo yet because it's not out of alpha. We don't want to show anybody anything that's going to change or, you know, yeah. They're all working on it behind the scenes. So instantly, like the developers, but then also everybody else at the booth was like, got all quiet, got all close to Chad, and Chad got into like demo mode. He's like, well, what you want to do here? You know, you want to go up and check your samples. Now see this noise here. If you have a little noise, you want to, he literally was doing a tutorial at the Redshift. It was so fun to watch because people just kept getting closer and closer and closer. And I learned a lot just by watching that. So I'm excited, you know,
that was fun
for them to, you know, when that all happens, you know, I think we should get you up on a show and basically do that as soon as we can, you know?
Well, people ask me, so I'm just going to talk about this cause it's kind of, I keep getting asked this question. So during the show, they released, like a soft launch, I guess you could say, of Redshift for Cinema 4D. And I think a lot of people mistook that for like, oh, it's out now. It's like, it's out. We can, it's good, right? We're good. And the truth is that, yes, you can purchase it and you can download it and all that stuff. But technically right now, as of August 7th, 2017, it is still in alpha. So it's still changing. So people were already hitting me up this morning about like, why am I not talking about or showing it and doing tutorials? Well, you know, we had a great conversation with those guys at Redshift, and they're dedicated to making Redshift as awesome as they can for our industry. And they don't want to jump the gun and have me do a bunch of tutorials for a UI that's going to change in a week and have to redo that or have outdated materials to teach people. So I'm working with them and making sure that we're not putting out anything that doesn't represent their product in a light that they want it to be represented in. And I'm just being respectful of that. And so when they tell me the light is green and the features are locked down, the UI is locked down, then yeah, I'm going to tweet and I'm going to do a Twitch and like introduce people to it and hopefully a lot more stuff. But yeah, just to kind of let everybody know, that's kind of the status of it right now. And those guys are really cool, man. Like it's really funny to me, like how people outside of our industry, just a little bit outside, not even like fully outside of our industry, but even just the people that are doing film effects and like, you know, that kind of level work, are so unfamiliar with motion design that sometimes we are in it so much that we forget that people outside of it don't really know about us and don't really, not us as in GSG, but us as in motion designers and how many of us there are and the kind of varied work that we do. It's always fun to sit down with these companies and explain our market because it's so varied and so random that they are excited, but also like, what, I don't know what to do with this information. But it's always great to meet companies that at least see it as an audience that they can help. And I think that's what I see when I look at companies like Redshift and Solid Angle and a few others, but they really want to help our industry, which is great.
Yeah. It's interesting to me too. It's, that was I knew from the start from, you know, watching MK12 and, you know, title sequences from movies I loved, that this was what I wanted to go do, this specific part of computer graphics, this motion design thing. But so many companies, you're right, are like, they, I wouldn't say they think of it as an afterthought. They just don't think of it at all. It's like visual, like filmmaking and all the buzz around movies and filmmaking and maybe title sequences there is so on everyone's radar at all times. I think, a lot of companies are just like, you know, they describe this market, and motion design is great because it's like, it's a growing market. A lot of the visual effects market is, you know, stagnant in some places. It's definitely changing a lot lately. It's got a lot of negative press lately. And so when we could show like, man, the MoGraph, look at this awesome community we have over here. Everybody's making all this fun stuff. It's a very sharing community, and it's really cool to see their eyes light up and just know that this world is out there. So it's really cool. It's really cool to see that the sparkle, get the sparkle in their eyes, little emoji thing going on.
Yeah, I think I was talking to Bo Pershall from Turbo Squid, and he was like, he is kind of comes from the olden days, as I'll fondly refer to it as, where I kind of come from, where it's like the way that 3ds Max community used to be is kind of how the Maxon and just motion design community is now. So he's always like very excited to do stuff with us and sponsor things and all that sort of thing, because he loves that feeling of community that I think a lot of different software companies wish they had, or even industries wish they had. And we have it because we work hard at it. You know, like this is what we're doing right now is really all in service of the motion design industry and like helping people. And that sort of thing is not really done in a whole lot of other areas. So it's a unique thing to our industry that I think we all need to just take a moment and embrace and say thanks.
You know, if you're out there, what I'd encourage you to do is just go ahead and give yourself a hug.
Yeah, go ahead and do that. A little back rub, if you can do it, if you're if you flexible. Time,
yeah, if you got time, find a friend, hug them too.
Yeah, whatever, man. Whatever works.
It's all good. We're all friends here. Speaking of hugs, one of the things that we got the most feedback about, positive feedback, at the booth was this podcast. And it was really interesting to hear from those of you talking about it that I always forget this, but there's so many motion designers out there that are like the only designer at their studio or one of maybe a couple, and they don't really have that opportunity to like go to lunch with 10 artists and like talk about renderers and talk about, you know, new stuff happening in the world. And they've talked a lot about how this was a chance for them to kind of like, you know, hang out and learn what's going on and listen to people talk about this. And so I don't have anything more to say about it other than like, thanks for all the feedback. It's always cool to hear that. And that's what we're trying to do here. We're trying to give you guys, you know, our opinions on this stuff, but also, you know, help you guys go in the right direction, try to steer, you know, hopefully we mess up all the time and then we'll tell you the path to go down instead of letting you make all the mistakes we made. So thanks for all the feedback and thanks for listening. This podcast is continue to be really fun, really fun to do and to see where it goes. So thanks for the feedback as always. I guess it's a good time to say, yo, you got more feedback for us? Hit us on iTunes. We're always looking for reviews and any mentions of us. And if you like it too, tell your friends. You know, this is what we're here to do, is to talk about motion design and hopefully, like I said, be part of the community.
Be the water cooler for the water cooler. You know, that's what I kind of see this as, is like this
digital water.
Yeah, this is kind of like I know what it's like in the very early stages of my career. Like, I didn't have anybody sitting next to me that I could just lean over and be like, hey, what do you think of this? Or have you ever done that? So this type of thing, like, again, I'm not going to get into, you know, everything you just said. I totally agree with. There's a lot of people out there that don't have that. And this is what the podcast is for them. And so I want to say to those people, we're here. And you may not be talking with us, but you're here and we know you're here in spirit. So thanks for listening.
Give yourself another hug.
Another hug. Another hug.
That one's from all of us.
Yes. All right. So enough of that mushy stuff.
Yeah.
What else? So I got to mention this because I have a feeling that I'm going to forget. So one of the other things that just struck me is like, holy crap. And it like blew my mind for, I think it was the whole day on Wednesday, was those of you that know me know that I love this compositing program called Fusion, and it's owned by Blackmagic. And everybody thought I was crazy. They thought, why aren't you using Nuke? Why are you using this? And I'll answer them right now, because Fusion is awesome and it's more of a design friendly node-based compositor than Nuke. It also doesn't cost $10,000 like Nuke X does. It also, this is the thing that blew my mind. So Blackmagic decides they're going to lower the price of Fusion 9 from, I believe it was $900 or $500, one of those. Anyway,
nine something.
They lowered it to $299.
Are you out of your mind?
$299 and free network rendering and a new 3D tracker. A new planar tracker. I mean, dude, I was like, what? This is insanity. And I'm still blown away by that right now. It's still kind of like just sinking in, like just how much tool you're getting for that price is just outrageous. Runs on Mac, runs on PC. This is not a paid endorsement, by the way. I just really like this tool. And if you're looking to get into node-based compositing, I mean, you can't beat that price. They have a free version too. If like $299 is too expensive for you, that's cool. We got a free version. Does HD? Doesn't have? You can't do plugins with it. And to answer the question before you already asked me, the full-on version you can use OFX plugins. So I use Real Smart Motion Blur in it. Lens Care Depth of Field with it. Mm. Everything that you're used to using plugin-wise in Nuke, you can use in Fusion. Now the other stuff. Trap code and whatnot, that's not going to work because that's like a After Effects thing. But I mean, that price, dude, like, come on, really? Like $299? That's ridiculous, dude.
That's pretty nuts. I've always known that you liked node compositing, and I remember you actually showing me one day, because I love After Effects. Like, I just love it. I'll always love
me
it.
Too. Like, no, I don't like, again, this is not a replacement. That's another thing that people kept asking me. They're like, well, does that mean I can cancel my Adobe thing? Like this, I want to get out of that. And I'm like, no, do not do that. This is not a replacement for After Effects. It's not going to do that for you. Like, this is a compositing application. This is a place where you do your 3D compositing of all your 3D elements, whatnot, green screen, 3D tracking, all that stuff. You're doing motion design with typography. Not going to recommend you do it in Fusion. Could you do it? Yes. Do you want to do it? Probably not. So for me, for instance, everything that you've seen me do at GSG and even before that was comped in Fusion. Do all my boards in Fusion, do all of our spots in Fusion. Anytime you see typography on any of our stuff, I'm doing that in After Effects. So just got to know.
I think that's what dawned on me, which is I asked you, like, well, how do you do all the text animation stuff? You're like, well, you just do it in After Effects, but you comp it, you finish it in Nuke. And yeah, I'm even thinking you, Chris.
No, no, Fusion, you, not Nuke.
I'm sorry, Fusion. See? I'm going to do that
see?
Again.
I know.
But I'm thinking you, Chris, have you played around with like a node-based compositor? Because I think, you know, some of the stuff that I know you've like kind of learned After Effects by watching some of the things that I've done and are getting better at it. I think because you know Espresso and are so familiar with like nodes in general, like you might like a node-based compositor might really speak to the way that your brain works too. Have you played with one?
I have not there. I mean, I've done a bunch of stuff with Substance Designer now, and that's also nodes, and it instantly clicked, and I instantly had like 200 nodes.
Oh, so. Dude, he is the perfect person for node-based compositing if he was into compositing, which I'm not really sure that he is.
Well, I think there's always that, like, you know, that extra layer, adding the depth of field. I know you bought, you got Frischlift, or was that what you got? Or
motion? Yeah, finally, I got Frischlift and Real Smart Motion Blur. Yeah. That's two things that I've heard about for years and had never actually used.
Must haves.
Yeah. Okay. So that's interesting. So I'm excited about this because I know, Chad, that you have a long history with node-based compositing. I've seen it in action that it does make a big difference for big 3D shots. You know, you tell me if I'm wrong, but if you have mostly After Effects stuff and you have a 3D element in it, you might want to finish it in After Effects. But if you have a mostly 3D scene and you just need some type or you need some lower thirds or you need that extra little finish, that's where something more like Fusion makes more sense, right?
Yeah, you got it right. You got it pretty much right. I would say that anytime that you have like a live action based shot, like you shot some green screen, you got to do some cleanup, you got to do a track. I prefer to use Fusion for that. It's faster, it's more robust, it's all that sort of thing. Now, if you're doing like motion design, which is more like a lot of typography, maybe you're even doing some edits in your After Effects timeline, do not do that in Fusion. You'll want to kill yourself if you try to edit in that application. It's not what it's made for. If you're comping, let's say you're doing a 3D render of, I don't know, a product of some kind, and you definitely, the way I would do it is render it all out, bring it into Fusion, comp it all together, do all the sweetening, grab those Gorilla Grade LUTs, put them on there, and then render that out, bring it into After Effects, and throw your type on top of it. And that's a good way to, then from After Effects, you can spit out all your flavors of QuickTime or whatever it is that you need to deliver. But Fusion is always the middle step for me. Or the final step, depending on what I'm doing. So it goes from 3D to Fusion, and then either comes right out of Fusion into whatever, or if it needs to go through that final editing phase or typography phase, it goes into After Effects. So that's kind of the way I do it.
Awesome. I'm excited to see more of that. Well, I don't know. Anything else for today? I feel like, we got our, anything else from Seagraph?
Let's Render Wars update. We didn't talk about the Render Wars.
Yeah, we talked a little, I guess, about the Redshift and stuff, but how is the Render Wars happening in general? It's been a couple weeks.
Yeah, I think it's alive and well. Like, I feel like there's now starting to emerge these two paths that I've been sending people down that seem to make sense. I did hear a lot of negative grumblings on the floor from users in regards to a toy and them and their them not listening to their user base, at least in the Cinema 4D world. A lot of frustration building there. A lot of people get looking to back a company that kind of will back them when it comes to GPU rendering. And so, yeah, it was interesting to hear their concerns and what they're not getting. But then on the inverse, I would hear people that are saying they're fine with the way Octane is and whatnot. So it really kind of depends on what you're doing. But I'm really excited for Redshift. Those guys are really cool. I like the product that they're putting out. I like the fact that they're listening. And then on the CPU side, I spoke to Arnold and those guys, and they're a fantastic group of guys and gals, and they're just making killer products, and they really want to help our industry as well. So that's also a very promising relationship, I think, with motion designers and the way that's developing. I know a lot of people are a little bit concerned about the Autodesk thing, but I got to say that their group that's part, the Solid Angle group inside of that organization, are cool guys, and they're down for motion designers. The other thing that was interesting that I don't think we talked about yet was Cycles. And a lot of people always ask me, like, why don't you use Cycles? Why don't you use Cycles? And so I'm just going to like put it out there. Like it's not that I don't like the feature set of Cycles and I don't like the implementation that Insidium put together, because it's fantastic. Like, of all the integration plugins that have been written, Insidium has done a fantastic job of creating a really nice way to get into that renderer. My concern isn't with that at all. My concern is that if I have a studio and I need to decide on a renderer, am I going to choose a renderer that is basically run by a foundation and not by a company? So it's an accountability thing. It's an ability to say, if we have a problem and we need to talk to somebody, do you talk to a foundation? Like, how does that even work? So I talked to a few people that are connected with the Blender Foundation and whatnot. I didn't talk to actually any of the foundation members or the high ups over there, but I am hearing that they're understanding that this is a concern, and this is why they're having trouble getting into larger studios. And I'm happy to say that they are working on a solution, hopefully, to sort of make people feel a little bit more at ease about using that as their production renderer in a studio environment, so that it's not just a single user working offsite on their own. They want to get it into more places that are doing larger scale work. So that's cool.
Render Wars continues.
Yeah.
On and on. Well, as always, we're learning this stuff as we go. That's the whole point of the show, is we're learning, we're talking to the people directly and trying to report from the field, if not from the actual company that we're talking to, by us playing with it, trying this out. And that's always been the goal here at Grayscale Gorilla, is we're just passionate people playing with the stuff, trying to get you the right info, trying to get you the right tools, trying to get you to do your best work. So as always, thanks for listening. Unless there's anything else coming up, we got a big end of the year coming. I'm sure we'll have more announcements soon. We're working a ton behind the scenes on some new stuff. So as always, if you have any feedback, please drop it down on the YouTube comments about anything you guys want to hear about, anything you guys want to hear us discuss, or any questions you have. And I'd like to do more of that too. Answer specific questions that you guys have. If you're struggling with, like I got to share this. I think we did before as well, but we talked to this person at Seagraph as well. We gave advice on how to negotiate your salary in one of our podcasts earlier. And we got direct feedback that, you know, people use that advice, walked in to their negotiation that they happen to have the next day for their new job, and got more money. Like, frankly, it worked, right? And so those are the things that we want to talk more about. We want to not only talk about the tech and how all this stuff helps you get your best work done, but talk about some of the more difficult stuff to quantify and start to talk a little bit about the business side of this stuff as well. So as always, we always appreciate your feedback. Please hit us up on iTunes or on YouTube. And man, stay tuned for another episode. We're gonna keep this rolling. Now that we're all finally back home, we look for some more episodes coming soon. So with that, unless there's anything last minute, we'll wrap this one up. We'll, you know what I've always wanted to know? Chris, what's your favorite color?
Ooh. I've gotten really, really fond of teal lately. I think teal is now my favorite color. Like teal. A nice aquamarine type of teal.
All right, teal. Chad?
Oh, man. I should have anticipated that question.
Come on.
Yeah, for me, it's kind of in the same vein, maybe a little bit more green.
Ooh, greeny teal. Well, at least mine's complimentary. It's an orange. So, you know,
I could have guessed that one. That's,
you know, everybody knows that one. Listen, that's easy. That's easy. Well, anyway, thanks again for joining us. Thanks for listening. And, we hope to see you in another Grayscale Gorilla podcast very soon. Goodbye, everybody.
Bye-bye. Bye, everybody. Have a great week.